Rise to Rebellion, Disc 15.
Boston Harbor, October 11th, 1775. At first he had tried to keep some order, packing the large wooden crates carefully, cataloguing their contents, books and papers, personal artifacts. As his library emptied, he could not keep the emotion away, his careful precision dissolving into bouts of anger and sadness. When the stevedores came to haul the crates away, he could not watch them, could not even be in the house as the last bits of the legacy of his command were carried to the ship. There had been a quiet ceremony, turning over command to Howe. The order from Dartmouth stated that Gage was to be in London so that he could assist in planning strategy for a new campaign the following year. The inference was that Gage's stay in England would only be temporary, and nothing in Dartmouth's letter hinted that Gage had been officially recalled. But to Gage and to all of his subordinates, there was no illusion about his loss of command. The phrasing of Dartmouth's letter was an act of kindness, not reality. And no one in Boston, certainly not William Howe, had any expectation of seeing Gage in America again. The ship had sailed after dark, and he did not stay up on deck, did not wave a farewell to the small official party on the wharf, did not watch as the lights of the harbor dropped away below the horizon. He sat alone in his stateroom, thought of Margaret, knew she was probably in London already, her ship having sailed a few weeks earlier, even before he had received Dartmouth's letter. She had finally accepted his pleading that she leave the dangers of Boston for the safety of his family's home. In the end, she had given up the protest, seemed to suddenly lose her loyalty to her friends, did not spend much time with anyone outside their home, did not speak of anyone left behind. He was relieved by that. Thought of her now. She will certainly know soon that I am coming. Perhaps she will see it as a new adventure, different from the last time. Perhaps she will enjoy finding a new home for the family, the children. He knew that what Dartmouth's letter had ordered was the work of great manipulation, his harsh critics kept at bay by the influence of his powerful friends. He had been allowed to leave Boston with dignity, might even be received that way in London. He thought of the king, wondered if it was His Majesty's hand who had given kindness to Dartmouth's letter. It could still happen. The reward for loyalty, the king's gratefulness resulting in some position of prestige, some final honor in a gracious retirement. He was already restless. Could not just sit in his stateroom feeling the soft roll of the ship. He went out, climbed the narrow stairway, stepped up into a breezy chill. There was a mass of stars, a crystalline, moonless night, and he moved to the rail, heard only the rush of water beneath him. He wanted to walk back to the stern, see a last glimpse, a flicker of light on the shoreline. But he stayed where he was, thought, "No, it is gone." He tried to feel the hopefulness again, retirement, Margaret accepting what must be. Perhaps it will be a long life, growing old together with the kindness that comes from recognition, smiles from a grateful nation. It will hardly matter what the duty was, or how bad the crisis. I have been a good soldier. I did all they asked of me. Chapter 37. Franklin. Cambridge, Massachusetts, November 1775. By now, all of New England had learned of the latest horror of this growing war. Two small gunships had been sent northward by Admiral Graves, had reached Falmouth on October 16th. The townspeople were given warning, were allowed to gather what possessions they could carry, and 2 days later, the ships opened fire, sending hot shot into the heart of the town in a bombardment that lasted over 6 hours. What did not burn quickly was dealt with in a more direct manner. Over 100 British Marines landed in the town and set fire to any structure left standing. To Graves, who had ordered the destruction without the approval of William Howe, it must have seemed an appropriate response to his own frustrations about the British inactivity in Boston. To the citizens of Massachusetts, and to the commander of the Continental Army, it was another infuriating example of British high-handed barbarism, and one more reason why their forces had to be strengthened sufficiently to drive the British away. Franklin had gone to Washington's headquarters as a representative of the Continental Congress, but the visit was personal as well. The trip to New England would give him the opportunity to retrieve his sister, Jane Meekham, who had escaped Boston and graciously been given sanctuary by a friend in Warwick, Rhode Island. Franklin was as close to his sister as anyone had been in their family, had written nearly as many letters to her as he had to Deborah. Together they represented the last survivors of a large family linked by the bond of the longevity not granted to their siblings. Franklin had not thought much of that before, but Jane was a fatalist, and as they both grew older, her letters had become stern reminders to him that he had a responsibility to give thanks, that his age was not an achievement or a reward for a healthy life, but a gift from God. Jane's life had been difficult at best. She was widowed, with a son of somewhat dull wits who had found no pathway he seemed capable of following, and a daughter whose disagreeable nature had isolated her completely from her mother's attentions. Franklin had heard all of this, every detail, but from the time she had been torn away from her home in Boston by the threat of a war she still didn't understand, he had begun to read a new emotion in her words, fear. This aging, fragile woman had nothing left of her long life in the town that had given her so much comfort. And what was worse, besides her illustrious brother, she had no one she could depend on to care for her. He had very mixed feelings about moving his sister into the house in Philadelphia. Sally barely knew her aunt, and Franklin knew enough of Jane's bullheadedness, so similar to his own, to appreciate how she might be quite a disruption to the routine of his daughter's young family. But he had to consider his own needs as well. Had come to miss Mrs. Stevenson terribly, her company, as well as her caring hand, something he was loath to ask of his daughter. If Jane needed his support, his solidity to dispel her own fears, he just might need her as well. It had been 12 years since Franklin had ridden through New England, but it was not so new to him. He had spent his childhood in Boston, most of his family had lived and died there, and he understood perhaps better than most why there were so many differences in the Congress between the cultures of New England and everywhere else. In Philadelphia, those differences still caused turmoil. No agreements had yet been reached on so many of the issues that might yet sink the colonies into submission to King George. When his carriage finally rolled into Cambridge, he had been impressed. Soldiers everywhere. And they looked more like soldiers now, some units actually in their own brand of uniform. He had seen all of the reports that reached the Congress, Washington's own frustrations from his first days in command, the chaos and squalor, but the camps did not appear as Franklin had imagined. There was order, tents in neat rows, men in formation, whole companies at drill. It was not perfect, certainly. The sharp crispness of the British routines would never be in these men, but as his carriage moved farther through the camps, he could not help feeling something new, unexpected. He had always felt a pride in the work of the Congress, that despite the turmoil and dissension, good work was being done, historic, monumental. Now, as he rode through what had become the Continental Army, he felt the same kind of pride, a confidence that for all the difficulties, for all the challenges, it was actually working. His carriage was led to Washington's headquarters by an escort of men on horseback. He climbed out, loosening the stiffness in his legs, saw that the building itself was a residence, but he could not miss the distinct sign of military command. Guards in uniform, standing at attention on either side of a tall wooden door. One man reached, in efficient motion, pulled the door open, and Franklin climbed the short steps, hesitated a moment, examined the man's coat, brass buttons on blue wool. He said to the man, "Thank you, soldier. And now he moved into the entranceway, saw activity everywhere, more uniforms, quick motion, men with papers, some passing by him quickly. He was impressed again, was suddenly confronted by a short stub of a man in thick glasses. "Dr. Franklin, welcome, sir."
"Mr. Gates, General Gates, yes, thank you."
Gates seemed to appreciate the correction, made a short bow. "Doctor, the General is in a meeting, but I assure you it will be brief. If I can get you anything..." Franklin could not help watching the activity still passing by him, listening to the sounds emerging from offices down the long hallway. One door now opened. They heard loud voices, and Gates said, "Oh, it seems they have concluded." Franklin watched the men fill the hallway, saw dogs now, two large black hounds rushing toward him, then passed out the door. Gates seemed flustered. "My apologies, Doctor." Franklin laughed.
"No matter, sir. Obviously, General Lee is present."
Gates grunted, and now Franklin heard an extraordinary burst of swearing, recognized the face of Charles Lee, the man moving toward him, and Lee stopped short, stared at him for a long moment, his face finally breaking out into a broad grin.
"Well, well, a lost traveler. Tell me, Doctor, do you never tire of taking journeys?"
Franklin bowed. Lee's smile was contagious.
"The adventure is in the destination, sir."
"Well, Doctor, there's plenty of adventure around these parts. Have to admit, if the Congress feels they have to stick their long noses into the business of this army, at least they sent someone too old to be horsewhipped. Good thinking."
Lee laughed, though Gates seemed to shudder beside Franklin.
"Excuse me, Doctor," said Lee, sauntering past. "Gotta make a ride."
When Lee was gone, Gates seemed to relax.
"I apologize, sir. General Lee is somewhat animated."
Franklin was still smiling.
"Don't concern yourself, General Gates. You need colorful characters to keep the place lively. I've always heard that a soldier's life is defined as organized boredom. General Lee is a remedy for that."
Gates sniffed, proceeded down the hallway.
"Please, follow me, Doctor."
Franklin obeyed, and Gates led him to the open door, stepped aside, made way for Franklin to enter. He glanced at Gates, nodded, a silent thank you, moved into the large room. He saw one desk, the large man filling the space behind, writing furiously. Franklin waited a moment until Washington signed the paper with a flourish, sat back, and at last noticed Franklin.
"Oh, forgive me, Doctor, I didn't know you had arrived."
Franklin bowed again.
"I am honored you can make the time for me, sir."
"Nonsense, Doctor, please sit down."
Washington held up the paper, shouted,
"Staff!"
A soldier appeared immediately, saluted without looking at Franklin, and Washington told him, "Deliver this to Mr. Fouts. If he protests, remind him that we are in continuous need of latrine duty. I will leave it to him to decide between the musket and the shovel." The man took the order, was quickly out the door. Franklin was curious.
"A bit of discipline, General?"
"In a manner, Doctor. What you see around you is a combination of military business and domestic concerns. The president of the college has been gracious to allow me to live here, as well as conduct the affairs of the army from this office. He still maintains his residence here, as he is certainly entitled to do. He simply pulled himself and his own affairs into one small portion of the house."
"Gracious indeed.
I have found, Doctor, that so-called lofty command doesn't eliminate mundane annoyance. I have two cooks here in the house. You may have caught the name of one of them, Mr. Fouts, for whom that order was intended, and to whom it is being delivered about now. I am not anyone's notion of finicky, Doctor, but Mr. Fouts fancies himself quite the expert in worldly cuisine."
"It is the Continental Army, General."
Washington smiled.
"Yes, well, if we fed this army in the same manner Mr. Fouts has attempted to feed me, there would be mass desertion."
He actually set out an elaborate dinner whose main attraction was bugs, covered in some kind of sauce, mind you, but bugs, nonetheless. I made the decision at that moment that Mr. Fouts would better serve this army by shouldering a musket. Not all of my orders are popular, Doctor. However, I am certain the entire headquarters will applaud that one." Franklin had not known what to expect from Washington, was surprised by the show of good humor. He saw Washington glance at another paper, his smile fading, and Franklin thought, "I am interrupting him after all. There is a war to contend with."
"General, I do not wish to occupy any more of your time than is necessary."
"Nonsense, Doctor. I can think of no visitor I would rather receive."
Is there any particular question I can answer, any guidance I can offer to satisfy your mission? Franklin glanced at the open door. Washington caught the look, said aloud, Staff! A man appeared, saluted, and Washington said, You may close the door. Sir! The man was gone, the door closing softly, and Washington seemed self-conscious. I'm not abusive to them, I assure you. Horatio Gates performs that task with enough zeal for both of us. I can't complain, for he has trained an efficient group. They certainly have more to fear from him than from me. He paused, looked at Franklin with total seriousness, then asked, What can I do for you, Doctor? Franklin moved the chair closer to Washington's desk, leaned forward, said in a low voice, You may be aware of both topics, both pieces of information I bring you. In the event you are not, I thought I had best be discreet. Few things are certain these days. One topic is perhaps good news, the other is most certainly bad. Washington seemed surprised by the show of intrigue. If it's all the same to you, I'd rather you start with the good. Yes, certainly. Are you aware that a committee of the Congress, on which I serve, has been established to open contact with foreign authorities? Yes, that's not such a terrible secret, Doctor. Are you aware that we have in fact been contacted by an agent representing the French government? Washington leaned back, wide-eyed. That I did not know. I thought not. The man's name is Bonvouloir. He approached the committee in the guise of a trader seeking a market, wanting to make some arrangement for selling arms and equipment for use by the Continental Army. Sounds as though you don't believe him. After much conversation, we have strong suspicions that he comes to us more as an agent of the French court than for his own personal profit. Certainly the French have an interest in knowing our strength, our requirements, and in what capacity we are capable of confronting the British army. If he is selling arms at all, they are probably coming directly from official sources in France. What does the Congress intend to do? The whole of the Congress is not entirely aware of Mr. Bonvouloir. Thus far, his dealings have been only with my committee. It would not be wise to bring this matter to open discussion. Word of this sort of intrusion would become public very quickly. It could be interpreted in London as an act of aggression. With everything else we are confronting, a British war in France, with all the complications that could produce, is not in our best interests right now. Washington leaned back in the chair, his hands clasped together under his chin. He stared at Franklin for a long moment. How are you handling Mr. Bonvouloir? He has been informed of the necessity of silence. He didn't require much convincing, seemed in fact more comfortable with all the nuances of duplicity than we are, one reason to suspect him of being more than he represents. We are not yet willing to reveal to him those things he so urgently wishes to know, your troop strength, for example. The inevitability of all-out war for another. How eager we are for foreign assistance, and so on. Until events unfold with a bit more certainty, we shall remain coy. The French would love to take possession of Canada again. They could be very useful to us if Canada was in our hands instead of the British. You have given me one more very good reason, Doctor, why our mission to Canada must succeed. Franklin had never been confident of the military reasoning behind the Army's first real tactical assault. It had begun in New York under Schuyler's command, but Schuyler himself had been ill, had turned the mission over to the command of Richard Montgomery. Montgomery's mission was no less than an invasion of Canada, in the hope of capturing Montreal and Quebec, and thus bringing Canada into the conflict against England as essentially a 14th colony. Even the more hesitant members of the Congress had been convinced that if Canada lay untouched, the British Army could certainly use it as a staging area to invade the colonies by way of the Hudson River Valley, a route that could conceivably cut New England off from the rest of the colonies while putting Ticonderoga and Lake Champlain back in British hands. The colonial troops had begun their march in September. Montgomery had led 1,200 men on the waterborne route up the Hudson Valley, accompanied by Daniel Morgan's Virginia Rifles, and a second column had begun the march overland, commanded by one of the heroes of the capture of Ticonderoga, Benedict Arnold. Franklin had questioned the strategy of mobilizing so many troops away from the British force in Boston, as well as commencing the operation when winter was not so very far away. But Franklin was not a military strategist, and surprisingly, many in the Congress had seemed so baffled by any discussion of military planning and so ill-equipped to argue its merits that the plan had been approved.
Forgive me, General, but is it improper to ask what progress we have made on that account?
Washington focused again.
It's not improper at all, Doctor. It's simply too soon. Had General Schuyler been fit to lead the operation himself, they may have begun by midsummer. As it stands now, we might not hear anything for a while yet.
There was quiet concern in Washington's voice. Franklin said nothing, and the military man responded to his silence.
You can say the word, Doctor, winter. We must pray for the best. Now you might as well tell me the bad news.
General, are you aware that King George has gone about Europe hiring mercenary soldiers?
Washington nodded slowly. I have heard rumors.
We have a few foreign soldiers right here. They have been receiving letters, families in Prussia, other places. I wasn't sure how much to believe.
You may believe it, General. The king has been successful in hiring as many as 20,000 men. We don't know what he intends to do with them, of course. He may use them to occupy British posts all over his empire, to free up English soldiers to come here.
That's too complicated, Doctor. It's dangerous for them to scatter foreign soldiers all over British outposts. Why risk inspiring some ambitious European to make those outposts his own? 20,000?
Are you certain, Doctor?
Not entirely, but it's a topic of public discussion in London.
Like the public discussion of our vast supply of gunpowder.
Franklin was confused, and Washington saw the expression.
It's not important, Doctor, but if this is true, if the mercenaries have been arranged, it will take time to organize them, ship them. My God, 20,000.
The reports say they are primarily Hessians. The king attempted to hire Russians, but Empress Catherine refused. If it is of any consolation, General, it doesn't seem to be a popular policy in England either.
So we can conclude that the Congress's olive branch wasn't well received.
We haven't heard officially. We know the king was to address the Parliament to open their autumn session. It is likely that he responded at that time.
But, Doctor, if he has hired 20,000 Hessians to deal with the colonial problem, what can he possibly say that will matter?
There are people in the Congress to whom it will matter a great deal, General. We shall find out soon enough.
Franklin had asked the driver to stop the carriage on the heights above Boston, had walked out among the soldiers who manned the defenses. He could clearly see the British troops below, on guard in their own lines at Boston Neck. He stood quietly, tried to bring back the memories, his brother teaching him to print, his voracious appetite for reading, his expertise at swimming. It had been a long time since he had gone on a stroll through Boston Common, longer since he had taken his habitual extended swim along the banks of the Charles. Now the Common was thick with British troops, the flow of the Charles broken by the great men of war. The memories were not as pleasant as he had hoped. Erased quickly by the sight he could not escape, the men in red who lined the works that severed the town from the rest of the colony. The stay was brief, and he boarded the carriage again to the kind salutes of the soldiers, his name filtering through their ranks, a commotion from men who appreciated a visit from a man so famous. The carriage would not delay now, the afternoon growing late. He would make the last part of the day's journey to a home just below Boston, an invitation to dinner with an old friend, Isaac Smith. He had not expected much in the way of social finery, had not considered sharing someone's table, the mood of the people close to Boston so attuned to the certainty of war. But the invitation had come to him even before he left Philadelphia, and the connection with its bearer had made the visit a pleasant necessity. The invitation had come from John Adams. Isaac Smith's niece was Adams' wife, Abigail. He arrived to a modest house, decorated in his honor by all manner of ribbons, dried flowers, brightly colored candles in every window. The reception was kinder than he could have hoped for, and the smells told him that dinner was already prepared, the house filled with the extraordinary aroma of roasted meat. The introductions had been made, Smith naming off the gathering of family, and Franklin had greeted each one with the same grace he had expressed so often. The family still gathered around their guest, and Franklin asked Smith, "Forgive me, but is your niece Abigail not here? I had thought she would be."
"Oh, quite, Ben. She's in the kitchen with my wife. They won't be a moment, I assure you."
Franklin reached in his pocket, retrieved a letter. "I have been given a rather important charge, you understand. I have a letter from her husband." There were cheerful giggles, excitement from the gathering of younger ladies, and Smith said, "Well, in that case, perhaps we should see what is detaining them. Now you all just wait here. You all will have ample opportunity to charm our guest." Franklin went with his friend toward the rear of the house, the smells of the dinner working on him, stirring a rumbling in his stomach. Smith preceded him, blocking his view of the kitchen.
"Now you two need to put that aside," Smith insisted.
Franklin heard a voice, familiar, Smith's wife.
"Very soon. The heat's up. Can't stop just yet."
The words were direct, stern, and Smith conceded.
"Well, all right, but our honored guest has an important matter to attend to."
Smith backed up now, allowed Franklin into the kitchen. He expected to see a great flurry of food preparation, bowls, trays, and platters, but the two women were standing at the stove with a hot fire between them, Smith's wife focused on the contents of a heavy iron pot. Franklin was prepared with a light-hearted greeting, but the words wouldn't come, and he thought, "What in the world? That's not food." The women were evidently hurrying, and the younger one removed thick cloth gloves from her hands, brushed at the mess of her hair, a smudge of gray on her face, said,
"Oh, my, Dr. Franklin, please forgive me. We are certainly not prepared."
"It is not a problem, madam. You would certainly be Mrs. Adams."
She smiled now, a short curtsy.
"Yes, I would be."
"Well, then I am pleased to give you some indication of just how much influence your honorable husband has in Philadelphia. I have here a letter for you from his hand. You might notice that it is being delivered not in the usual custom. While I may balk at the suggestion that the mails are somewhat inconsistent, in this case, by the enormous power of your husband's persuasion, the Postmaster General himself has made this delivery personally."
He held the letter out to her, could see tears now, her hand shaking, and he was surprised.
"Oh, dear lady, I did not mean to tease. Forgive me, I certainly appreciate how serious an occasion it is to receive the letter of a loved one."
She smiled at him, held the letter close, and he felt embarrassed now. "You and your grandiose pronouncements." He looked at the older woman, saw her stirring the large pot, concentrating carefully, her hands protected by the heavy gloves as well. Abigail glanced back at her aunt.
"Are you ready?"
The older woman nodded, all seriousness, one quick glance at Franklin.
"Excuse me a moment, doctor,"
Abigail said. She moved quickly, put the gloves back on, reached down into a wooden box on the floor, retrieved a small handful of pewter flatware, and handed it to her aunt, who lowered the spoons and forks slowly into the heavy kettle. Abigail looked at him, wiped again at the sweat on her brow, creating another dark smudge.
"Forgive me, doctor. We'll be finished here in a short while. We'll not delay dinner. The food's already prepared."
Franklin was watching the older woman. "She's melting the pewter. Mrs. Adams, forgive my curiosity. What are you doing?"
"Why, doctor, we're assisting the army. We have been told that pewter works as well as lead. We're making musket balls."
Chapter 38. Adams. Philadelphia, November 1775. He had spent the early morning with Sam, a quiet breakfast. Then the messenger came, carrying the letter. The name on the paper was familiar, Hiram Jones, an acquaintance Adams had made years before in some obscure legal hearing up north, somewhere around Falmouth. The letters were common now, and he had become used to the sentiment, knew to expect some message of support, the good wishes of the people back home. More often lately, there was advice, opinions,
the kindly meant prodding from people who could never understand the business of this Congress, the frustrations that Adams was confronting daily. He had become almost numb to his feeling of helplessness, the endless sessions in the chamber, the fading optimism that each new dawn signified nothing new at all beyond the changing numbers on the calendar. His sense of despair came from the news in Braintree as well, an epidemic Abigail could only describe as dysentery. Her letters and the devastating news had pulled his mind away from the affairs of the Congress. The illness had cast a dark shroud over the entire town of Braintree, and beyond into the countryside. But worse for him, Abigail had written of the horrible effects on his own family as well. His brother Elihu had been one of the first victims of the epidemic, and soon after, Abigail had been suddenly devastated by the loss of her mother. When her letters included the terrifying news that their son Tommy was affected, he had considered withdrawing from the Congress, returning home, tending to his first responsibility. Even a brief visit would serve some purpose. At least he could be there with them, offering some comfort, some relief from the extraordinary burden his wife was enduring. As he planned his resignation from the Congress, he received another letter telling him that Tommy was greatly improved, had survived what so many of the others had not. It was Sam who had counseled him to stay in Philadelphia after all, that there was truly nothing he could accomplish by riding into an epidemic and possibly succumbing to the sickness himself. The deaths were a fact he could not change, and he had ultimately accepted Sam's logic, that he could do much more for the well-being of his family if he continued his work in the Congress. Though he had returned to his work in the committees, enduring more of the endless talk in the chamber, the scare was a harsh reminder that there was a world beyond the affairs of politics. All the oratory had become a bit less meaningful. He finished his breakfast, saw that Sam was still eating. This was something new. His cousin not assaulting the plate, rendering it clean in a few seconds, the man's ebullient personality reflected in the way he shoveled in his food. Sam was clearly more relaxed now, resigned, perhaps, that no amount of explosive anger would accomplish anything in Philadelphia. Adams watched him examining a piece of dried fruit. Sam took a bite, struggled, the fruit resisting him. He gave up, tossed it on his plate. "Too green. They picked it too soon. Even preserved, it's inedible." Adams looked at his own clean plate. "I had no difficulty. I don't think I noticed what I ate. It doesn't seem to matter." Sam looked at him for a long moment. "You going to read your mail? I know that name, Hiram Jones, kind fellow." Adams examined the letter, finally opened it, read to himself, and suddenly his casual expectations were shattered. My God! The British have burned Falmouth. The Navy, just like Charlestown. He handed the letter to Sam, who scanned it quickly. "No explanation why, no reason. He says no one was killed." "Thank God for that." "But why burn Falmouth? There was no threat there. Even the militia had probably all gone to Cambridge." Sam read the letter again. "We must be sure this is accurate. This will have great impact on the Congress." Adams was rather surprised at Sam's reaction, had become so used to the fiery outbursts, the explosions of cursing, but quiet calm was much more often Sam's way now, and Adams said, "I don't know how to react to this. I've been so angry at all of the British mindlessness, I don't even feel surprised. Of course they would burn an innocent town. What is so unusual about this? Should we not be expecting other letters just like this one? Perhaps there is more to this then one additional outrage, yet another example of British barbarism. This could very well be the King's response to Mr. Dickinson's olive branch petition. This attack did not come from some rogue ship. Mr. Jones mentions two naval gunships. This was planned. The orders coming from someone in authority." Sam, surely the King would not be so barbaric. "I'm not at all certain of that. This news will certainly create a problem for Mr. Dickinson's people." Adams stared at the letter again, felt as much confusion as anger. He had found it more and more difficult to tolerate the stubbornness of the Conservatives. Dickinson himself had threatened to break his followers away from the Congress, form a body of their own to address the differences with the Crown. Whether Dickinson could actually succeed didn't really matter. The disruption to the business of the Congress likely would have caused the entire process to collapse. Adams set the letter aside. "This will do much to unite sentiment against the King, of that there's no doubt." Sam smiled now, a strange reaction. "You see, there is some good in every tragedy. I have learned a great lesson through all of this, cousin. Patience. If we feel we are confronting an abyss, just wait a while, and sure enough, our enemies will build the bridge. From the beginning of this, for years now, every time I despaired at the people losing interest in their cause, every time I exhausted myself trying to inspire the people's hostility toward the King's oppressive policies, His Majesty has done something amazingly idiotic and solved my dilemma." He picked up the lump of dried fruit from his plate, held it aloft. "You cannot harvest the crop while it is still green. You must allow it to ripen. This Congress is still green, but that is changing. The people cannot be pushed into accepting independence from their beloved King. They must ripen to it. What I have had to learn is that if we exercise the proper amount of patience, the King, the Ministry, the Parliament, any or all of them, will provide the fertilizer. They are certainly qualified on that count." There was a knock on the door. "Mr. Adams, are you available, sir?" "You may enter, yes." The door opened and Adams rose, shook the hand of Richard Henry Lee, who said, "I have heard of some extraordinary news from Massachusetts. Are you aware the British Navy has burned your town of Falmouth?" Sam held up the letter and Adams said, "We heard this morning. It may be that this is the answer to the Olive Branch petition. How very appropriate for a despotic king to communicate with his subjects through the muzzle of his cannon. And you have not heard?" Adams glanced at Sam, who stood now, said, "Heard what, Mr. Lee?" "We have received the King's decree, his message to Parliament. It arrived last night on the packet. The delegates are being sought out now. There had not been much expectation of new business before the chamber today, but that has most definitely changed. We should be convening in a very short time." "Have you read it?" Adams asked. "Do we know yet what it says?" "What of Mr. Dickinson? Surely he has been informed?" Lee laughed. "I have not read it, John. It's under the royal seal. You can be sure your Mr. Hancock is impatiently waiting to begin the show himself." The session was called to order, and Adams could feel the mood of the chamber, very different, the delegates in muted conversation all around him. The King's opening address to Parliament was an old custom, and usually no one had much interest in its details, including, it was said, the King himself. But this time the difference was obvious. No matter the message, it was a break in the silence from London, and certainly there would be some response to the petition. He searched for Dickinson now, saw a cluster of the Conservatives grouped in a far corner, watched as Dickinson emerged from their huddle of conversation. The man moved slowly, seemed ghostly pale, and the others now gathered behind him, some spreading out, separating themselves from the man who had led them. Adams was painfully curious. Well, certainly he must know something. This seems to be a day of momentous news. Hancock was at the rostrum now, quieted the delegates. "We have received a letter from Mr. Penn, the distinguished gentleman in whose charge we placed the Olive Branch petition. Mr. Penn declares with absolute certainty that he made numerous attempts to gain audience with the King and was not successful. He further states that he made a like number of attempts at presenting the petition through the hand of others, friends of the royal court who might be more successful in reaching His Majesty. In all cases, the message returned to Mr. Penn was that the King would not consider receiving any such petition. It is the Chair's view that despite opposition from many in this Congress to the sentiment contained in the Olive Branch petition, as authored by Mr. Dickinson, we can be certain that though our efforts did not succeed, no one in this chamber shall bear the curse of failure." He paused, and Adams caught Hancock's glance, expected some sort of knowing smile, but Hancock was deadly serious. "Mr. Penn's lack of success is not the conclusion to this woeful tale. Though the king did not consent to receive our petition, he can be said, in any event, to have given more than a silent response. The chair considers it entirely appropriate to relate to this Congress the official address of His Majesty King George III upon the opening of the autumn session of his Parliament. The chair is of the belief that the king's statement will put to rest any doubt as to His Majesty's regard of our kind wishes, as this Congress expressed to him in the olive branch petition. Hancock gazed around the chamber, and the silence was absolute. He raised a coil of paper, made a show of removing a thick purple ribbon, unrolled it, held it up, read aloud. "Whereas many of our subjects in diverse parts of our colonies and plantations in North America, misled by dangerous and ill-designing men, and forgetting the allegiance which they owe to the power that has protected and supported them, after various disorderly acts committed in disturbance of the public peace, to the obstruction of lawful commerce, and to the oppression of our loyal subjects carrying on the same, have at length proceeded to open an avowed rebellion, by arraying themselves in a hostile manner to withstand the execution of the law, and traitorously preparing, ordering, and levying war against us." Adams could feel the air in the room drawn in, one great inhaled breath by the men around him. While Hancock read aloud, Adams looked straight at Dickinson, saw the man staring ahead in a look of deathly sadness. "All our officers, civil and military, are obliged to exert their utmost endeavors to suppress such rebellion and to bring the traitors to justice." Adams focused on Hancock, expecting still to hear something about the petition, some reference to Dickinson's effort to appeal to the king, whom Dickinson himself still so revered. But the flow of words suddenly stopped, the text complete, and Hancock read the closing, "Given at our court at St. James, the 23rd day of August." So that's it. That's all of it. There is no response to us at all. He looked again at Dickinson, the man's head bowed low, the room still holding to the cavernous silence. Hancock said, "Does anyone wish to comment?" All eyes were on Dickinson now, and the man did not look up. The discussions began again, and Adams felt a tap on his shoulder, so it was Patrick Henry who raised his hand. "Mr. President, I care not to insult this proceeding with the most obvious of observations, but I must make mention. The king has decreed that the American colonies exist in a state of rebellion, which will be suppressed by any means available. We are already aware that His Majesty has sought out and procured the services of mercenary soldiers. We are already aware that His Majesty's Navy has shown no hesitation in bringing a destructive fire to American towns. These events do not signify the conclusion to our present state of crisis. They signify only the beginning. Despite anyone's allegiance, despite anyone's optimism, anyone's loyalty to either a king or a cause, to an empire or a colony, to God or to man, you must not fail to understand what King George has decreed. We can no longer hold ourselves to be protected by British law. We are no longer governed by British constitutions or British edicts. We have been severed from the empire by the king's own hand, and by the king's own hand this Congress has come to represent a people united, who abide now only in a state of nature." Henry was through, and others now jumped into the fray, most expressing outrage at the king's extraordinary leap into a declaration of outright hostilities toward the colonies. Adams still watched Dickinson. "Well, then, what would you have us do now?" The man began to look around the chamber, and Adams could see his eyes gazing absently, curiously, as though seeing the great hall for the first time. Dickinson looked directly at him now, the man's expression blank, vacant, and Adams wanted to respond with a look of defiance, even some shameless gloating. "You fool, now where is your loyalty? Are you still so eager to grovel at the feet of your king?" But there was no victory here, and Adams could see Dickinson now as a man who has had his heart ripped away, his loyalty punished, his life thoroughly altered in one terrible moment. Dickinson still looked at him, but there was no recognition. The man's mind far off in some private hell. And Adams felt his defiance slipping away, suddenly felt pity for the man. Dickinson believed it. Believed with a passion that his king is a good man, that loyalty is rewarded. And no matter what he has tried to do, no matter how much valiant effort he has put into blocking this Congress from its opposition, his king has not only ignored him, he has condemned him.
Braintree, Christmas, 1775. No matter on which side of the debates the delegates had aligned themselves, to a man there was great apprehension for the new year. So much was still to be decided, in Philadelphia and in London, in Cambridge and in Boston. The king's decree had laid open a course that both frightened and excited, the loyalists not quite believing that the king would ignore their vulnerability, the radicals understanding that no matter how much fascinating philosophical truth might lie in Patrick Henry's description of their state of nature, without cohesion, without some hard thread to hold the colonies together, there would only be anarchy. And colonies in chaos would prove to be an easy conquest for the king's troops. Many of the delegates had conceded that little would happen until the new year, and many had agreed that Christmas was best spent with family. They all had the need, a long, slow breath, a quiet time away from the turmoil. The new year would come soon enough. Adams was astounded to learn that he had been appointed Chief Justice of the Massachusetts Supreme Court, the Assembly choosing the one man who not only was qualified, but would most certainly not be vulnerable to the threat of being tarred and feathered by the Sons of Liberty. At any other time he would have accepted the honor as an extraordinary gift, the pinnacle of all his ambition. But as grateful as he was for the appointment, he felt the new responsibility was as much a burden as an honor. The Assembly accepted his apology with complete understanding. The duties of the High Court would have to wait, at least for a while. No matter what legal issues filled the dockets of the newly organized court, his priority was still Philadelphia, confronting the great void of government he feared for the colonies. Beyond all the debate, the specific duties of the committees, Ben Franklin's careful communication with the foreigners, the committees for subsistence and funding for the army, one question had never been truly addressed. It had caused him more sleepless nights than any harsh words from John Dickinson or threats from King George. If there was to be a full-scale war against the king's army, a revolution that might ultimately sweep away all forms of English rule and law, no one had yet come up with what would follow. No one had designed an acceptable plan for how the Americans would govern themselves. The house had been a mob scene, Abigail commanding the preparation of a great Christmas feast. It was far more than a family event, more than a dinner for the boarders in their home. Abigail had combined her energy with the other women in the town, the food brought out from root cellars and pantries and cupboards, the neighboring farms contributing cupboards, It was a show of religious spirit beyond the usual celebration of the season, a thank you for blessed relief from the dysentery epidemic, glad tidings for the safety of those who had fled Boston. Abigail would turn no one away, not even the militia troops, whose nearby camp continued to swell with the men who had responded to the call to join General Washington's army. With the darkness, the house emptied. Grateful guests returning to their homes, some simply climbing the stairs to their rooms under the Adams's roof. It was very late, and the house was quiet, the children long asleep, their guests in their rooms. He was in the kitchen by himself, working a mortar and pestle, grinding a handful of small, dark beans into coarse powder. He was not very good at kitchen implements, and more of the powder found the floor than stayed in the mortar. He put his finger in the bowl, testing the consistency of the powder, and her voice was behind him now, playfully stern. "You are messing up my clean kitchen. What in the world are you doing?" He held out the small stone bowl, showed her the dark powder. "Coffee.
I thought I would try to make it myself. I've seen it done. Why are you not asleep? I thought you were exhausted.
I'm too tired to sleep. I wish we had some wine left. It appears they drank it all, and besides, I find little comfort anymore in retiring to an empty bed.
She tried to hide a smile, took the bowl from him, reached up in the cupboard, retrieved a small cloth bag, poured more beans into the bowl.
Allow me, Chief Justice Adams. I've become quite good at this, actually. Our guests have come to enjoy it.
He handed her the pestle, watched her crush the beans with quick, efficient motion, and now she looked past him to the stove.
Where's the kettle? Didn't you heat the water?
Ah, I was going to do that next.
Husband, if you begin heating the water first, it will be ready when you finish grinding the beans.
He felt foolish now, utterly out of place. I should know better than to attempt those jobs for which I am not qualified. She looked down at the floor around his feet.
Well, I know of one job for which you are well qualified. While I finish making the coffee, you can sweep up your mess.
They sat in front of the fire, and he sipped at the steaming cup, his face curling with the bitterness. She was watching him.
You don't like my coffee?
It's not your coffee. I'm still getting used to the taste. Some of the delegates positively gulp the stuff. I thought at first they were being patriotic, overly enthusiastic in their distaste for tea. But it has become the style, certainly in Philadelphia, served at every tavern, every dining room. I find I'm still undergoing a weaning process. I don't miss the tea. I'm just not yet accustomed to the coffee. She laughed softly.
I have thought that if we had been weaned away from tea a long time ago, we might have saved ourselves a lot of trouble. He chuckled at her joke, but soon grew serious.
Your life has changed a great deal.
I regret that I am not here to assume the burden. I have missed you terribly, John, but I have managed. If my life has changed, it is a positive thing. The people I have met, the visitors. I shared a marvelous dinner with Dr. Franklin. I received a visit from General Washington on one of his inspections. I have never been so surprised. I had become used to soldiers marching here and there, but I never expected to have this enormous man and his huge entourage suddenly filling our yard. Completely frightened the children, except for John Quincy, of course. He was ready to march off with them.
We are fortunate that General Washington accepted the responsibility for organizing the army. There might never have been an army at all without his experience.
I believe it's more than that, John. You wrote me of your favorable impression of him, but I was quite struck not just by the soldier, but by the man. Dignity with ease, such confidence and modesty. I was as concerned as many around here. I heard all the talk, a Virginia gentleman, a slaveholder, no less. What can he know of our problems? But I saw it in him, the soldier and the gentleman, an agreeable blend. Now, on the other hand, his General Lee...
Adams laughed. Yes, Charles Lee. I would describe him as the absolute contrast to George Washington. Did he bring his dogs?
It seemed more as though they brought him. There were such differences between the two men, but similarities as well. When I first saw General Lee, looking all of the uncouth frontiersman, I did not expect eloquence in his words. He quite surprised me. She sipped from her cup, stared at the fire. John, I never expected that I would be called upon to learn so much. It is as though the entire world has suddenly passed by this place, offering me lessons I never dreamed of. General Washington would approve, I think. I find that I have risen to my own command right here. I have become quite comfortable instructing the men to do their jobs. It is a relief to me that some of them can do my own work nearly as well as I can. Her words dug at him. The reminder that he had left his own duties behind. He said, "It should not be like this, not at all. When Tommy was ill, I prayed that you would set everything else aside, tend only to my son.
It is a mother's love that cures when nothing else will. You should not be devoting so much of yourself to those things best left to men." She made a small sound, looked away from him now, stared into the fire, and he drank the last of his coffee, set the cup aside, waited for a long moment, then said, "I find myself sleeping less and thinking more. I'm very afraid that the Congress will allow this crisis to so consume our attention we will not be prepared for the consequences of independence from England. There must be structure, there must be organization, not just for one colony, but for the union of all 13 colonies, for the people. Well, being that a man is doing so much thinking on the subject, I'm sure only the best and most wise solutions will follow." He was surprised by the edge in her voice, and she looked at him now, the firelight reflecting on a stern glare. "Husband, I have been doing some thinking on the subject as well. Does that surprise you? I have had some time to myself, you know. The dysentery did not entirely ignore me. I carried my own share of this illness. I did devote as much time as my churning stomach would allow to caring for your son. Regrettably, with my mother's passing, I had only myself to care for me. I do not complain, however, lest you think I am out of my place." He wanted to answer her, but the heat in her words held him silent. "I am greatly curious just what all is being fashioned by your Congress for the benefit of the rest of us. I am as curious as you are what form of government you create. Will it be decided by each colony's assembly? Will the Congress offer a plan that applies to all colonies, or only those who allow it? What if 6 colonies form a union and the other 7 do not? I am more and more convinced that man is a dangerous creature and that when given power, even the most noble find the temptation to grasp for a bit more than his share. The greatest fish swallow up the small. If there is dissension among your ranks, will the strongest simply ignore the weak or conquer him? And may I ask, husband, when you speak of the people, just whom are you referring to? In your new code of laws, can it be hoped that you will perhaps remember the ladies? Can it be within your male spirit to allow some authority to flow our way? Or are you to be as ungenerous to our gender as your ancestors? You certainly must know that all men have shown their first tendency is to tyranny. You who are brought to so much agitation by your own lack of representation, consider that there are a large number of us who might yet feel the same." She was staring at him, and he could see she expected an answer. Well, we are recommending that each colony form its own government, such as the elected assembly here. We have considered that the election of men to their assemblies, whether in each colony or in the Continental Congress, should originate in an electorate composed of men of property. I'm concerned that we not allow the mob to exercise control over this process. Power follows property, and too many men might allow themselves to be influenced by those men of the greatest wealth. By allowing anyone who owns land to vote, and by ensuring that anyone of even modest means may own land, the electorate will be brought level. He paused, and her stare did not change. We must not discard our systems with whim. Man is, after all, not the master, but the subject of a higher law that governs us all. She began to laugh, a small giggle at first, her hand covering her mouth. Then the sound rolled out, and he was suddenly anxious she would awaken the rest of the house. She tried to speak, but her laughter blocked the words, and she leaned back in the chair, slowly regained control, bringing out her handkerchief, wiping her eyes. He was completely baffled by her reaction. "Oh, my dear husband, all those fancy words, and they may as well fall in a jumble over a cliff. All right, so we must be tolerant while you who are so wise decide our future course. But I must ask, does your Congress presume that we are in the midst of a revolution?" "I am certain that many of us feel that. There will still be debate, of course, some still believing that we must only succumb to whatever the king requires of us, and all will be set right. Well, my husband, to the people around here, those who have been allowed to escape Boston with their lives left behind them, those whose homes were burned to the ground in Charlestown, there is no debate at all. There are a great number of people who have nothing in their lives but the passion to fight for your cause, who are sleeping in tents around Cambridge because they are inspired by General Washington. And if those men win this war, if your cause succeeds, then you will say to them, well then, in our new government, all the power shall be held tightly in the hands of men of property, that only men of property can decide what is best for everyone else. If you attempt that, my dear husband, you will soon find there to be a second revolution, and it will have nothing to do with the king.
January 1776. He had loaded the carriage, said his goodbyes to the children. He was anxious to return to Philadelphia, but he could not escape the pain of leaving his family yet again. He climbed up on the carriage, a vantage point, gazed up the long hill beyond the houses, a fresh blanket of snow covering everything, the rock piles just white mounds, the trees in the orchard bowed by the weight. He saw something moving beyond the yard, could see a thick furry tail tipped in white, a red fox stalking slowly through the snow, stopping, listening for sounds of some creature close by. He thought of calling his son, knew that John Quincy would enjoy watching the drama play out, but he stayed quiet. He will have plenty of time to enjoy this. Perhaps one day I can enjoy it with him. Behind him in the road another carriage rolled by, the sound muffled by the snow. He heard his name, turned, saw a familiar face, a neighbor wishing him well. He waved absently as the carriage passed, but said nothing. He looked for the fox again, saw it standing frozen, staring back at him. Now it began to run, bounding through the snow, disappearing into the orchard. He climbed down from the carriage, the snow crunching beneath his feet, and he moved toward the house, saw the door opening, saw her standing in the doorway, holding a bundle wrapped in red cloth. She looked down at the snow. "Here. I don't have my proper shoes. I made you some muffins, and there's a jug of cider. I used up the last of those apples. We lost so many, it was truly a shame, just rotted from the rain." She seemed to run out of words, and he took the bundle from her hands, could see she was crying. She scolded herself in a low voice, "I will not do this. I don't want you to remember my face with red eyes." He wiped out her cheeks gently with one finger of his gloved hands, said, "I will return quickly this time, I'm certain of it. My duties are here. Don't lie, John. You will come home when it's time to come home and not before. There are more people requiring your presence than just your wife, or even the Supreme Court." He looked down at the bundle in his hands. "I am hopeful. We may be running out of time, but I have confidence in those men. We are fortunate to have so many. Dr. Franklin, Mr. Henry, Mr. Lee, we will find a solution." "I believe you will, John. Take strength from the prayers that will follow you there. Everything you do, every decision, every act, every law, will reflect on the people you represent. Do not forget that out here in this little place, we may only know the truth of what is happening by your letters. I so treasure hearing from you." He hugged her, could not speak, moved quickly to the carriage, climbed up. He looked back toward the doorway, saw her small wave, her smile, and then she backed into the house and closed the door. He had gone by way of Cambridge, would pass through the camps of the soldiers, picking up the well-traveled route southward. The small carriage was traded for a better ride, and he was provided a driver, a team of two. All along the journey his mind worked, and he would make notes, details, small essays to himself on the principles he was trying to adapt to the situation at hand.
to understand them himself before he could expect anyone else to understand. At night he would be entertained by some local official or even by the soldiers themselves, camps of militia everywhere he stopped. But then would come the dark silence of another sleepless night, and the notes and details would flow back through his mind. He began to feel a strange fear, his confidence giving way to doubt that no matter what wisdom emerged from the Congress, no matter what solutions a handful of men could devise, none of it mattered if the king buried them in the deluge of war. And if it was not the British, it would be the people themselves, their amazing differences, the culture of the Carolinas, forced to compromise with the culture of New England. But much of that was just geography. And this was about so much more than land and boundaries. That frightened him the most. That perhaps John Dickinson was right, that most people had no taste for independence, that most people cared not a whit about anything the Congress would decide. How many people, in the privacy of their own homes, so far from anyone else's crisis, families whose greatest concern is their own well-being, how many of them wish only that the king would sweep all of this away, all this talk of rebellion and Congress and fights over tea? How many have already begun to respond to the king's decree with sorrow and regret, forgetting the abuses, the policies that brought it all about? How many have forgotten that what brought the colonies together in the first place was British arrogance and bloodshed? How many will close their doors and their minds to the greater needs of the colonies, will disregard the death of strangers and destruction of towns far from their own worlds? If we cannot keep the people attentive, if we cannot show them that they must stand united, then nothing we do in the Congress will count at all. There cannot be a revolution if the people choose not to fight. There cannot be independence if, above all else, the people still love their king. He had reached New York, another dinner, and now another quiet night. When he arrived that afternoon, his host had handed him a pamphlet, something new, sold on street corners, circulating with a hum of fresh excitement. He had regarded it with mild curiosity, put it away for later, and now, in the low lamplight of his room, he recalled it, pulled it from his bag. Perhaps it will help me sleep. A little reading to distract my mind. He held it up, saw the title, thought, odd, rather quick to the point, and no author's name. Well, with all the attention this seems to be attracting, someone will admit to it sooner or later. He opened the cover, read the title again. Common Sense. Chapter 39. Franklin. Philadelphia, January 1776. The committee he chaired was to meet that morning. It offered another opportunity for the Frenchman Bonvouloir to make some genuine connection to the colonial heartbeat. He had begun to dread these meetings, knew the routine, the Frenchman professing his innocent neutrality, then immediately launching into a grand speech about the terrible injustices of King George and the divine right of the colonists to be properly armed. The sentiment throughout the Continental Congress was that an alliance with a foreign power might be the only means for a colonial army to have any success against British might. Despite the double talk coming from Bonvouloir, if the man was indeed a direct conduit into the court of the French king, even if an annoying one, Franklin knew that he should be kept close at hand. The dangers of foreign intervention on their behalf were obvious. Every major colonial power on earth would prize what America had to offer. The Spanish already had possession of the southern half of the continent and would certainly welcome an opportunity to extend their influence north from Florida and Mexico. The French influence was still felt in the western wilderness along the Ohio River with both the Indians and the white traders. Some in the Congress were advising extreme caution in allowing the French to gain a political foothold in the colonies, which might reinvigorate the power in the West that they had lost in the war 13 years earlier.
Franklin recognized as well that the main passion igniting what King George had now labeled the rebellion was a spirit of independence, something that had been nurtured by the culture of the colonies themselves. By inviting an alliance with a foreign power, there was danger that the very strengths of that alliance might lead to a new and even more loathsome dependence that no one in the colonies would accept. The sessions in the Congress had become much more businesslike again, as they had toward the end of the previous summer. Dickinson's influence had declined dramatically, and thus so had the debates. Franklin had grown disgusted with the stubborn allegiances of the Tories, both in the Congress and elsewhere, even if Dickinson had been shamed into silence by the King's condemnation. Other voices throughout the colonies still declared that independence was no option, that the crisis was still only a family quarrel that could be settled by a colonial apology.
This ends Disc 15.